April Dunford, positioning lady. I've heard that this is what you call yourself.
That's me, the positioning lady.
Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So you have literally written the book on this thing that we call positioning. It's called Obviously Awesome. It is available on the Design Discipline bookstore. And I actually have read this book twice because your message was extremely relevant to me, and I'll get to that later. But let's start with the basics. So what even is positioning?
I used to be a VP marketing at startups and tech companies, but I switched to consulting about 5-6 years ago. And when I switched, I decided I was going to narrowly focus on positioning as my focus area. And at the beginning, that was a challenge because people say, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm a positioning consultant. And they're like, what's positioning? And so I think that positioning is really misunderstood, even amongst marketing professionals. So, you know, if I were to get 10 vice presidents of marketing together and say define positioning, you would probably get 10 really different definitions. So most people confuse positioning with things you want to do with positioning. So they'll say, oh, positioning, it's exactly the same as messaging, or it's just like your tagline. I get that one a lot. Mm. Or the one that really bothers me is when people talk about brand positioning and they smush them together. And I don't think that's right. Like, I think there's branding and there's positioning, and those two things are actually entirely separate. In fact, messaging, branding, go-to-market strategy, all these things flow from positioning, but you got to have positioning straight first. So I define positioning this way. Positioning defines how your product is the best in the world at delivering some kind of value that a well-defined set of customers cares a lot about.
Okay, I'm going to get back to that, but I want to sort of start from the start of the things, which is, I guess, your story. So I teach design at the university, and many of our students then go into careers related to product design, some of them into marketing. And you said you have been a VP of marketing, which is a very high level senior executive in charge of marketing at a company, basically. So how did your life and education and career play out to make you the expert on positioning? What were some of the steps?
Yeah, so I'm a bit of an accidental marketer. So I didn't start out with an idea that I was going to go have a marketing career. I actually studied engineering in university.
Oh, cool.
But when I graduated, I got a job at a startup, and the job that I originally got hired for was a product marketing job. And a lot of that job involved doing presentations, going along on sales calls, or going to trade shows and doing demos of the product. So I got hired mainly because I was a decent public speaker. That was about it. And the product that we were selling was quite technical. So they needed somebody that at least knew a little bit about databases and SQL queries. And I was good at all that because I had studied engineering. But then what happened was the product that I got assigned to, we ended up doing repositioning shortly after I joined. And so I was involved in that repositioning effort. And the product was not doing well pre-repositioning. In fact, we were toying with the idea of potentially shutting it down. And then we repositioned it and it took off. The product became wildly successful. The company got acquired by a big company in Silicon Valley. I inherited a team of folks after the acquisition, and my boss quit, and people thought it would be a good idea to put me in charge. And I had no background in marketing at all. And there I was running this big global marketing team with a great big budget and all the rest of it. But at that point, things were going really well. The product was really hot and selling a lot. And so I decided, well, I'm just going to learn this marketing stuff as I go along. So I took a bunch of courses. I read a bunch of books. And from that point forward, I just decided marketing's my jam. This is what I do. And so I'm a bit of an accidental marketer. Interestingly, though, like that first experience came out of a repositioning that we did on a product. And even after the acquisition, I ended up being in charge of a handful of other products, which we repositioned as well because they were kind of weakly positioned. And then after I left there, I went to another startup, and it turned out the first thing we did there was reposition the product as well. So early in my career, I got exposed to the power of positioning, if it were, like, you know, how you could have something that didn't seem to be doing very well in the market, reposition it and have it grow really fast. So right from the beginning, I think I was sold on this idea of positioning. And so that's what kind of sparked my interest in exactly how does this work and how can we do it more effectively and efficiently. And I probably spent the next 10 years trying to perfect a way of actually doing positioning, or a methodology that would get us to really good positioning really quickly.
Where in the world were these experiences? Was it in the United States?
Yeah, well, I'm based in Canada. The original company that I worked for was here in Canada, but then we got acquired by a company in Silicon Valley. So I was kind of splitting my time between Toronto and Silicon Valley. For a while, I lived in Silicon Valley with a different company. For a while, I lived in New York with a different company. But home base is always, for me, been more or less Toronto, although I've, you know, I was in Paris for a couple of years too, but but yeah, mainly I've been in Toronto.
I see. The reason I was asking is that these words or concepts that define this like landscape of careers and different jobs and things, you know, you mentioned marketing, engineering, product is a word that is used often in North America. Design, you hear a lot. So these concepts kind of change their meaning sometimes based on where you are in the world. Can you comment a little bit about marketing versus design versus product?
Yeah, you know, so I can comment a lot about marketing versus product. Design, I get into that side of the house, and I you know, and I don't really know what I'm talking about. When I started, there was a clear line between product management and marketing. So marketing in a B2B tech company back when I started, marketing was primarily concerned with lead generation. Like, how do we generate leads for the sales force? We didn't touch product at all. Like, you know, the product just was what it was. We didn't have too much control over that. Our job was to take the product and try to get leads for it so we could make as much money as we could. The product management side of the house, they were seen more as the conduit between the product and the business. So there was the development team there, you know, that were the programmers. And then there was the business side of the house where we, you know, we're over in marketing and sales. And so product management was supposed to be making sure that we're building things we can sell. So we're building things that the market wants. We're building things that marketing can actually drive leads for. We're building things that the sales team knows how to sell. And then my first job was in product marketing, which at the time was an even more niche-y thing, which was product marketers were essentially experts on the market. So they understood deeply what was differentiating and what wasn't differentiating. They understood different segments of buyers and what they cared about. So if you think about it, positioning is kind of a fundamental thing that product marketing does. So I think my background in product marketing was kind of unique at the time, because you certainly didn't meet very many product marketers, and that had been a thing that I was doing right from the beginning. Design, I think, in a lot of ways, it straddles the three, at least in the design groups that I've worked for. They're touching marketing and sales, but they're definitely involved on the product side of things and making sure that we're building something that, you know, that works with the customers we're trying to sell to. And then obviously they're touching product.
That is actually my kind of home. I teach design at the university. I'm at the design department. And when I read your book, it was like mind-blowing for me, because you basically articulate in this book this method that we can use to formulate and articulate positioning. So how do we decide what the positioning is, and then how do we like represent it. Basically, that was what your book was about. And this is kind of like the missing side of design for me. So when we teach design, or when we talk about design in our little world, we talk about methods a lot. So this is about how you get the information, how you interview people, how you sort, categorize ideas, prioritize ideas. But your book is kind of focused on how to analyze the information that we have. What questions do you ask to the data or to the users? How do you filter what you know and you know, analyze the customers and markets and product features and make these decisions so that we really get to what really matters? So when you think about this other side, as an experienced marketing and product leader, what is your opinion on product design methods and design research and market research and so on? So concretely, have you ever observed that rigorously applying certain methods and or research methods or design methods, that it makes a difference as opposed to doing things quick and dirty?
Well, so it's interesting. When I started in the first startup that I worked at, it was very typical of the time, which was like 25 years ago. If you rolled the clock back 25 years ago, most startups started out as consulting businesses. So they started out building custom software for companies that would pay for that custom software. And then what would happen is they would notice, like, hey, we keep getting asked to build the same thing over and over and over again. Why don't we just build it as a product and sell it as a product? So almost all startups started that way when I started it. So the good thing about that is you had a product out in market, and there were already customers using it. Mm-hmm. And so you had at least a little bit of validation on the idea. Like, you knew people were asking for it. You had at least a handful of customers. You knew it was good. And so then the product would get built with that in mind. Later on in my career, people really switched to building a product startup from scratch without doing this consulting. And for the most part, the methodology, if you could call it that, that they were using to try and figure out what product they should build and who's it for, was this kind of lean startup stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, we have sort of a thesis. We're going to try to test that thesis out. We're going to build a minimum viable product. We're going to iterate on that. We're going to try to figure it out. And then, you know, if it works, it works great. If it doesn't, we throw it out and we try something else. In my case, most of the companies that I worked at, I would come in later. So I would come in as like the first professional marketing hire. Usually they'd have a couple of junior people doing some kind of marketing, but I would come in, maybe they just raise some money, or they decide, you know what, now's the time. We're really going to invest in marketing, drive a lot of leads, you know, really accelerate the growth on that thing. And then let's go hire a VP. So they, you know, that's when I would come in. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, at the state when I came in, if I look back at what had happened before, there at some point there was really good customer input. Either it was because, you know, it was built out of the need of a particular customer, or they came from a services background, or they had done this really rigorous lean startup thing, you know, minimum viable product, testing it out, getting lots of feedback. But usually at the point when I came in, you know, this idea of going back to figure out what the customers want and what's going on in the market had sort of fell by the wayside. It was like, okay, we know, and now we're just executing on it. And typically I would say some of this stuff was where the root cause of weak positioning would come from. So you get this thing where the founding team would say, hey, we're building a thing and it's email. And because we hate email, we think email sucks. So we want to build better email. So we got this thing, email, we put it out in the world. We get people using it. We add things, we take things away. Fast forward 2 years, and all of a sudden you've got this thing, and you know what? It's actually chat. You think it's email, but and maybe chat didn't even exist when you built this thing. But if you looked at it now clean, you would call that chat. You wouldn't call that email. You know, we've always thought of it as email, you know, and that's our baggage. And we know where we came from. And 2 years ago, it absolutely was email, but now it's something else. And that gap is confusing the heck out of customers. So they're seeing this thing, it kind of looks like chat. It doesn't do what I expect email would do. And yet you're calling it email. I'm so confused. And then they don't buy. And so a lot of the weak positioning I see comes from this what I would call positioning baggage, where the company has been started with a really firm idea of this is the problem we're trying to solve. This is the product. This is the market category it sits in. But the market itself has evolved. Categories around that category has evolved. Your product itself has changed. And you fast forward and the market category, the way you're positioning that product today isn't actually very strong positioning. And if you were to reposition it today for what it does today, you would position it in a completely different way. So I don't know if it's the methodology that gets us into this problem or what it is, but all I know is by the time I showed up, there's usually a gap between the way we're thinking about it internally and the way customers think about it when they first see it. And closing that gap is the key to me being able to do good stuff in marketing.
You came to an interesting point because there was a question that I was intending to ask you based on my reading of your book, where you advocate for basically surveying the market periodically to determine who the best customer is and if necessary, then reorienting how we describe the product to suit that best customer that we have, for example. Conventional wisdom in design is that you should indeed do this periodical review of the market, but then you should tweak the product itself to suit the customer. So you start with the customer. Your customer is a constant, whoever that is, whoever you have decided to provide for. So we have three variables. We have the product itself, we have the market or who the product is for, and then we have how we describe the product, how we speak to the market. So how do we stabilize them at the same time? Like, can you speak to how this equation with like three moving parts works out in practice?
So the way I look at it is I'm mainly concerned with two of those three, right? Because I feel like the way we talk about it, you know, comes out of the other two. But what we have to have is this great fit between I got to have a product and I got to understand who fits really well with that product. So as a marketing person, if I came on board to a company that was already selling, already in market, let's say they've already got a few million revenue, the first thing I would do is I'd look and see what exactly are we competing with? And it sounds like kind of a weird way to start, but it's actually a really super interesting way to start. Because if I go to the customers and I say, why do you love our stuff? You'll hear all kinds of things that don't matter, right? Like they'll say, oh, because your support's so great. And that's not why you picked us in the first place, you know, like, but if I go and ask customers, if my product didn't exist, what would you be doing today? And there's usually two kinds of competition. So one is whatever they were doing before they adopted our stuff. So status quo in the account. And a lot of times that isn't software, like, or at least software, it's not software that looks like us. So a lot of times it's, you know, I would use a spreadsheet or I would hire an intern to do it, or, you know, it would just be manual processes, whatever. And then there's, you know, if the customer did decide, okay, we can't do it that way anymore, we've got to do it a better way, so we're going to switch to something else. If it's B2B, generally what happens is they make a short list of products to look at, and I got to beat those too in order to win a deal. So if you think about it, in order for me to transact business with a customer, I have to beat status quo and I have to beat whatever else lands on a short list with me. So in my world, if I can understand that deeply, then that kind of gives me a stake in the ground to say, look, in the market today, right now, here's who we have to beat in order to get a deal. Not who we'd like to be, not who we think might be our competitors. No, who's actually our competition? If we didn't exist, this is what customers would be doing. And I know the answer to this if I have salespeople, because I can go ask them and say, what's the status quo? And they'll tell me what it is, or who else is on the short list. They know, right? So I put that stake in the ground. I say, look, I've got to beat this in order to do a deal and transact business with this customer, right? I got to beat this. And then you say, well, what have I got to beat them with? And all I've got is my differentiated capabilities, which are mainly features, but sometimes it's other things. And so, you know, I can make a list of all those features, and then I can translate those features into value for the customer. And now what I've got is, here's my differentiated value that we can deliver that the other alternatives cannot. And that is actually the fundamental basis of everything we need in marketing to understand. But once I've got that, then I'm like, okay, this is my differentiated value that I can provide over the other things that customers are looking at. When I have that, then I can say, all right, well, not everybody cares about that the same. Right? I could go sell this to, you know, and a lot of times I'll talk to startups and they'll say, oh, we're selling to small, medium businesses. You say, okay, but not all small, medium businesses care about these three things that you do really well. And so what you're looking for is, well, what are the characteristics of a target account that make them really, really value this two, three things that you can do? And it's that match between the two sides that we really want, right?
That's now, interesting.
What I get a lot is companies will come to me and they'll say, you know, we sell to mid-market today, but we want to sell to large enterprise. And I'm like, okay, but, you know, but if you're not selling to large enterprise today, it's, you probably don't have a product that serves large enterprise, right? So you're going to have to go build some product to do that. But what we can do today is figure out exactly what kind of companies are a really good fit for what you do. Maybe some of those are large enterprise, but we need to figure out this fit. So in my world, when we're thinking about positioning, what we're thinking about is, how can I optimize sales and marketing for the product that I've got today? And how I do that is I say, okay, well, what am I really, really good at? What value can I deliver that no one else can? And who cares about that? And that's where the magic happens. Now, your strategy might say, oh, I don't want to sell to these people. I want to sell to these other people. Well, you're going to have to figure out a product roadmap that gets you to that. I can't help you with that. And positioning doesn't solve that problem. That's your product strategy solves that problem. What positioning is all about is, how do I make it crystal clear, this is the value that uniquely we can deliver, and here are the people that this is for, because they really care about that value we can deliver. And that's it. So in my world, so once I figure that out, then I can figure out what the messaging needs to be to communicate that, right? Once I say, okay, well, I've got this value for these people, how should I talk about that, right? I need to talk about that in a way that these people understand, that communicates this value. But that's just messaging. The hard part, in my opinion, for positioning is, how do I find this match between what we can uniquely deliver and who cares a lot about that?
So it kind of seems to imply that we are already, or the company that we're talking about is already doing something. There's some kind of product, some kind of, let's call it infrastructure, already in place for doing some kind of thing. And you figure out how to fit that with the existing markets. And that's really interesting, because like a lot of the approaches that we talk about in design, so we talk about human-centered design, sometimes we talk about sprints, design thinking, things like that. These are largely geared towards innovation, invention. So you're trying to come up with something where there's nothing. And it was interesting, because even within those approaches, I was able to myself find a lot of value in your message, in your methodology, and bring in the approach of positioning, even at very, very early stages of the project. So in this project, in design discipline, I've actually sat down and gone through some of the exercises that you outline in your book to figure out the message, the positioning of this podcast, and it helped me tremendously. So it does apply across a lot of different scales, you know, larger companies, smaller companies, startups, even like a relatively tiny project like mine. And it's clearly oriented towards business. But I'm wondering if it applies at an even smaller, tiny scale. So on the scale of an individual, for example, do you also practice kind of intentional positioning in your brand and your career? Like, can we extend your positioning method to how we navigate our careers?
So here's a couple of things. I often get asked, does my methodology work if your product is a consumer product? Because I, you know, my background is all business to business. The companies I work with are business to business. And my first answer is, I don't know, because I don't do consumer. So I don't know. It wasn't designed for that. It wasn't built for that. I have had people selling consumer products come to me and say they've used it and it works. And I'm like, that's great. But your mileage may vary. You know, maybe it works well for you. Maybe it doesn't. I will say that I think there are really different forces at play if what you've got is a consumer product. And it's largely around this concept of alternatives. So in the first step, when we're talking about alternatives, like what would you do if my product didn't exist? If it's B2B, and particularly a B2B sale that's complex enough that we have a salesperson, we can kind of count on the idea that you know, there's somebody making a deliberate purchase. So they're going to shop around a little bit. They're going to make a short list of competitors. They're going to do their research. They're going to go do stuff. If I'm buying bubblegum, I don't do that. I walk into the convenience store and whatever's there, I make a choice. And it might be because I like the color blue, or it might be because I have an affinity for that brand, or it might be because it was the only one available in the shop. And there are all these other things that come into play. If I'm going to buy shoes, you know, maybe it's more emotional about how I make my decisions. So I think the first step of this, when it's consumer stuff, is a lot more complex and would necessarily mean that you need to go do some deeper customer research and have customer interviews to kind of unearth exactly how is a customer making a choice. If it's B2B, if I have a salesperson involved, we know the answer to these questions. It's not hard to answer. But if it's B2C, I think that is quite hard to answer. Now, coming back to like individuals or position in a podcast or positioning, you know, like I will say that I have positioned myself as a consultant exactly this way. You know, if I could tell you exactly what the competitive comparables are, if people didn't use me, what would they do? Well, I know what I did when I was a vice president of marketing. I kind of mumbled around on it. You know, I took a stab at it and we iterated on it as we went along. And what, you know, what, why is it better to work with me? Well, it's faster. It's more efficient. Now that I have a book out, I think one of the biggest competitive comparables to working with me is to just pay $10 and buy my book and do it yourself. You don't necessarily need me. And I'm fine with that and having that as a competitive comparable. So, you know, I do it all the time when people call me and they ask about working with me as a consultant. I'll usually just put it out there. I'll say, look, you can do this yourself. There's no reason why you can't do this yourself. And you can do it your way. Or if you want to do it my way, you can buy my book and do it my way. And the book is there to tell you exactly how to do that. And then, you know, there's advantages to working with me. And I can outline what those are. You know, I've done this 200 times, so I kind of know it. I built the methodology, so I know where you might get stuck, where you might not get stuck. There's advantages to having an outside facilitator break through some internal politics or, you know, make sure that everybody gets a chance to talk about what their concerns are. And if you do it with me, I'm going to guarantee that we get to end a job in a week. And so it's pretty fast. It's pretty efficient. You're likely to get a very good outcome because I've done it 200 times, but it costs a lot more money than $10 to buy the book.
For sure.
So you've got to know that value. But so I think that, you know, could I position an individual? I've certainly positioned myself that way, but the methodology was not built for that. It was built with B2B tech companies in mind. Can you use it for other things? I think you can. The other thing I want to address just briefly is this idea of, well, what do you do if your product hasn't launched yet? So I get a lot of companies come to me and they're you know, they're still in the early stages of building the product. So they don't have it out market. And this first step is, well, you know, if you didn't exist, what would customers buy? And how do I know that if I haven't sold anything yet? And for that, I think you can use my methodology to develop what I would call a positioning thesis, which is you say, look, we're building a product. And in that product, there are a bunch of baked in assumptions. So we assume that this is what status quo is the account. These are the other competitors that are going to be involved. So we assume this is the competitors. Therefore, this is how we're different. Therefore, this is our differentiated value. We think these kind of customers are going to really love that. And here's why. This is the market we're going to position ourselves in. Mm-hmm. So what I've got is a thesis. It is untested, but it is a thesis. Now what happens is we launch the product. And what generally happens is our thesis is not entirely correct. Like it's kind of correct, but it's not totally correct. So we messed it up. Like some of those assumptions were not true. And then after we get our first wave of customers, then we can really tighten it up because now we've got some feedback and some data. We know more about how customers behave. And that's a really good time to tighten it up. So my advice to folks when they're first launching something new is it's good to have a positioning thesis, but I would actually, in terms of my messaging and how I present that positioning to the world, I would actually keep that positioning fairly loose until I've gotten my first wave of customers and I know for sure what's going on. And then I know how to tighten it up. Because if I launch with really tight positioning, I might tighten it in the wrong places and actually miss an opportunity with a customer's potentially a really good fit. So my terrible analogy to this is, you know, you're designing something and it's a tuna net. You're a fisherman, you designed a tuna net. And that's what it is. It's been designed to catch tuna. And that's your thesis, right? But I don't know if it's true or not. I don't know if it works that good for tuna. Mm-hmm. And so when I started selling the thing, I think I'd be better to just say, you know what? It's a net. It's a fishing net. It's good for all kinds of fish, big fish, like any kind of big fish. And let's get some people out there fishing it with it, throw it out in the ocean, and then let's see what we pull up. And maybe we find out like, oh my gosh, grouper. Like it's actually really, it catches some tuna, but it's really good for grouper. Like it's amazing for grouper. And then I can really tighten it up and say, it's a grouper fishing net. It's amazing. It's the best one the world has ever known. And sell the heck out of the grouper fishermen because now I know and I've validated it.
I actually do think that the philosophy, at least maybe not every single detail, but the philosophy of what you describe and teach does apply to the level of the individual as well. And it kind of comes from having studied a bit of economics as an undergrad. It's interesting that in economics they talk about, you know, the labor market as just another market. So the basic concepts of economics, you know, supply, demand, scarcity, these apply to all kinds of markets. And the situation where you are the provider of some kind of value or some kind of service, and there are various employers who might be interested in purchasing that from you, the same principles, the same dynamics largely apply to that situation as well. But on the topic of education, I teach at the university, as I said, and I'm in the computer science department, but I teach design. And when I work with younger people, I do try to give them skills and ideas that will be useful to them in employment situations. So what are some skills and ideas that you wish younger people could be armed with? I know that you're not doing management anymore, so you're a consultant now. But if you think back at the years when you were practicing as a leader, so what can I teach my students, for example, to prepare them for the leadership of someone like April Dunford?
One thing I'll tell you, there were a handful of things that I felt like on the marketing side of things, I could teach you almost anything. But what I couldn't teach you, to be excited about the work. And a lot of times in the interview, that's what I'd be looking for. Like, are you excited about the work? Like, you're going to show up every day and be sort of jazzed to be here. And then the other thing I couldn't teach you is how to write. Like writing skills are a thing. And I don't have time to teach you how to write. And yet you can teach yourself how to write. Like, that is a very learnable skill.
Yeah.
And I think anybody that had something on their resume that proved that they could write, got you ahead of the pack in my books, because it was like, I can't teach you how to do that. That's one of the few things I can't teach you how to do. I can teach you a lot of other tactical marketing things, but I can't teach you how to write. It got so bad in that, I used to give people a writing test in interviews, because it's so fundamental to so much stuff we were doing in marketing. And sometimes I'd be hiring people with a technical background. And some of them are just terrible writers. Like, the whole reason they went into tech is because they hated everything on the English side of the house. So I would give people a test, and being able to write a coherent couple of paragraphs would go a long way when you were interviewing with me.
Yeah. I mean, writing is like, I mean, what we call human history is basically begins with the invention of writing. You know, it's one of the most amazing technologies ever invented. And it's one of the most powerful skills that anyone can use anywhere, you know, even with your friends. Like, I got this like handwritten note from a friend last week. I was like massively impressed. Like, no one sent me a handwritten note in like 10 years. It's so easy to impress people with writing if you have that power. I have some kind of quick fire questions that I like to ask a lot of the guests that come on this show. What is a question that you wish you get asked in all these podcasts, but no one asks you?
You know, I've done a lot of podcasts in the last year, so I feel like I've been asked almost all of them. It's interesting to me. I don't get asked that much about, you know, what do you do if like, how do you know if your salespeople are just terrible? Like, how do you know if it's a positioning problem or it's actually like a marketing and sales execution problem? Mm. I'm surprised I don't get asked that more, because when people come to me looking for help, I'm trying to filter for that, because all I can do is help you with your positioning. If you have a marketing execution problem, then I can't help you with that. If you have a sales execution problem, I can't help you with that.
What's like a sort of top symptom of that?
If you've got, so the first thing you have to understand is you have to have some happy customers. If you don't have happy customers, then maybe you've got a terrible product that is just unsellable. That's a thing. So that's the first thing. The next thing is sometimes what I've got is companies, they'll come to me and they'll say, you know, we're just not generating as many leads as we should. And the leads that do go over to sales, you know, sales manages to sell them, but I feel like we could be generating more leads. And then I'm like, okay, well, what, you know, explain the positioning right now. And sometimes people explain the positioning to me and I'm like, that actually sounds really good. And so if the story sounds good, it resonates with customers, those customers are signing on and going through, you're just not getting enough of them, then I'd say you've got one of two problems. Either you're not doing enough marketing or the right kind of marketing to get that message in front of prospects, or the addressable market of people that are a good fit for your stuff is just not big enough, which means you got a product problem. So I need to figure out how to have a product that fits with a bigger range of customers than the one I'm fitting with now. So I do a lot of trying to filter with that. Sometimes what you've got is the story sounds really good. Marketing's doing really well. Everything's going great until it hits sales and then it falls off the cliff. Sometimes that's a sales problem.
So you kind of...
Then I get into like, well, how, you know, what do the salespeople do? You know, is marketing giving them a script? Is marketing giving them a demo? Like, how do they... Is sales telling the same story as marketing? And if I get a lot of, I don't know, well then maybe this is a sales execution problem.
I see. What are some books that you recommend very frequently to people that you work with, other than your own, obviously?
Yeah. So I recommend mine the most. No. So there's a handful of books that I keep coming back to. Lately, I'm really interested in how you take positioning and build a really compelling narrative for sales out of that. And so the book that I'm recommending a lot recently is this book called The Challenger Sale. It's quite old. I think it came out in 2012, maybe. So it's about 10 years old. But the data, the research that they did to develop that book was really, really important. I don't always agree with the conclusion they come to. And it's a book that's really about a sales methodology. But if you put that aside, the data underneath it, in the parts of that book when they're talking about the data, I think is really, really valuable, particularly if you're trying to figure out how to do B2B sales well. So I come back to that book a lot. I'm trying to think of other ones that I think are really valuable. Ever since I've started in doing marketing and startups, I always recommend this book called, and it's even older, called The Four Steps to the Epiphany by this guy, Steve Blank. And it was the book that Lean Startup was based on. And I think that if you believe in Lean Startup or you're interested in Lean Startup, you owe it to yourself to read the original book, which was this Four Steps Epiphany.
Fascinating. I hadn't read or heard of either of those, so I will for sure check them out. So what is next for April Dunford?
I don't know. I'm looking forward to getting out of lockdown. I'm looking forward to going to conferences. I'm looking forward to drinking beer on the patio. My future is simple and it involves being with other people. I'm working on some stuff for the fall. I've got a couple of things. Like one, I have an idea for another book. That is kind of a follow-on book to the one that I've got out now, which again is really all about how to build a compelling sales narrative out of good positioning. So I'm really interested in that right now. So I'm spending a lot of time thinking about that and doing talks about that and working with customers on that.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so that's taken up a bit of my time, but yeah, the rest of it, I really, really hope that we're back to doing face-to-face things in the fall.
You sound like you enjoy your work a lot. So I do imagine that you spend a lot of time on your work. What is the second thing that you spend most of your time on?
I feel like my world's gotten very small during lockdown. I mean, I think if you had asked me that question in 2019, I would have said, I do a lot of traveling.
Yeah,
but since March 2020, my world has gotten small. So I live in Canada, and I have a cabin in the woods, and we kayak and you know, it's all in the water, and it's gorgeous. And I would say nice. that's kind of my fun thing I'm doing when I'm not working is I'm out in the woods. Looking at cool. beavers and things that Canadians do.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Sounds like the Swedes, actually. The Swedes also enjoy the outdoors. And
yeah. I think we are equally outdoorsy in that way.
Yeah. The only thing that's different is, I guess, it's the maple trees versus oak trees or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. We probably have different kinds of animals and trees and things. Yeah, we have maple trees. We've got beavers.
So where can we find you on the internet?
Well, my website is aprildunford.com. Every once in a while I get motivated and I write a blog post, but I'm not a very regular blogger. The only social media where I'm really active is Twitter, and I'm at April Dunford on Twitter. So you can follow me there. Every once in a while I'm ranting about some positioning thing over there.
Cool. Yeah, that is where we met, actually. You are the, I don't meet a lot of people on Twitter. I think you were the first one actually to exchange messages and then meet.
Twitter's my favorite social media. I think, I made an investment in other social media. Like for a while I was on Instagram and that I couldn't keep it up. And then, and the same thing with LinkedIn. I wish I was more interested in being active on LinkedIn, but I find it, the content there sometimes bothers me. So I had a hard time being really active there, but Twitter is fast. It's easy. The messages are short. It fits in my time. Yeah. I like it.
True. It's really fun. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. thank you for joining me. And I am looking forward to your next book, and maybe we can have another chat after that one is out.
Sure, that would be awesome. Well, thanks so much for having me. This has been great.